Statesman, a dialogue of Socrates with Theodorus, visitor and stranger.
I owe you a great debt, Theodorus, for introducing me to Theaetetus, and to our visitor as well.
Yet soon, Socrates, you'll owe three times that debt, once they've finished working out the statesman and the philosopher for you.
Well now, is that really how we ought to report what we've heard from the master of calculation and geometry, my dear Theodorus?
What do you mean, Socrates?
I mean that you've set an equal value on each of these men, when in fact they're farther apart in worth than your own art's proportions would allow.
Well said by our god Ammon, Socrates, and justly too, you've called out my arithmetical blunder with quite a memory for it. I'll settle accounts with you another time. But you, stranger, don't tire of your kindness to us, go on and give us, in whichever order you prefer, the statesman first or the philosopher first, just choose one and take us through it.
That's what we must do, Theodorus. Since we've once put our hand to it, there's no backing out before we've brought the business to its end. But what am I to do about our young friend Theaetetus here?
What about him?
Should we let him rest and take on his fellow athlete here, Socrates, instead? What do you advise?
Yes, take him on, as you say, they're both young, and resting will make it easier for them to bear the whole exertion.
And indeed, stranger, the two of them seem to share some kinship with me, from somewhere or other. The one of them, you all say, resembles me in the look of his face. The other shares my name and my title, which gives us a kind of kinship, too. We ought always to be eager to get to know our kin through conversation. Now with Theaetetus I myself talked yesterday, and I've just heard him answering questions, but I've done neither with Socrates here. We need to look into him, too. Let him answer you now, and me another time.
So it shall be. Socrates, are you listening to Socrates?
Yes.
Do you agree with what he says?
Certainly.
Nothing on your side seems to stand in the way, and I dare say I should get in my own way even less. But after the sophist, it seems to me, we too must now hunt down the statesman. Tell me, should we count him too as one of those who possess knowledge, or how?
Yes, that way.
Then we must divide up the branches of knowledge, just as we did when we were examining the sophist earlier.
Perhaps.
Yet the cut doesn't seem to me to fall in the same place, Socrates.
Why not?
It falls somewhere else.
It does seem so.
Then by what path will we track down statesmanship? For we must find it and set it apart from the rest, stamping it with one single form of its own, while marking all the other branch paths with one other form, so that our mind comes to think of the whole of knowledge as two kinds.
That job is yours now, stranger, I think not mine.
All the same, Socrates, it must become yours too, once it's plain to us both.
Well said.
Now then, isn't arithmetic and certain other arts akin to it, bare of action, offering only knowledge?
That's so.
Whereas the arts of carpentry and manual craft generally possess a knowledge bound up organically with action. And together with that action, they complete bodies that didn't exist before.
Just so.
On this basis, then, divide all the branches of knowledge, calling one the practical, the other purely cognitive.
Take it, then, that the whole single body of knowledge has these two kinds.
Now should we set down the statesman, king, master, and household manager as all one and the same, calling them by a single name? Or should we say there are as many distinct arts as names we've listed? Better follow me this way.
Which way?
Like this, if a private citizen is capable of advising one of the public physicians, isn't it necessary that he be called by the same name as the art he's advising in?
Yes.
And what of this, if a private man is skilled at giving advice to a ruling king? Shall we not say he possesses the very knowledge the ruler himself ought to have?
We shall say so.
But surely that is the knowledge belonging to a true king, kingly knowledge.
Yes.
And whoever possesses this, whether he happens to be a ruler or a private citizen, will rightly be called kingly, purely in virtue of the art itself.
That's only fair.
And household manager and master of a house are the same thing.
Of course.
And further, will the scale of a great household or the bulk of a small city make any difference at all in respect of rule?
None.
So then, as we've just been examining, it's clear that there is one single knowledge concerned with all these things, and whether one calls it kingly, statesmanly, or the art of household management, let's not quarrel with him over it.
Why should we?
But this much is plain, that any king can do very little with his hands, and his body as a whole toward holding on to his rule, compared to what his mind's understanding and strength can do.
Plain enough.
So would you have us say the king is more akin to the cognitive kind of knowledge than to the manual and generally practical kind?
Of course.
Then shall we put statesmanship and the statesman, kingship and the king, together as one and the same?
Clearly.
So we'd be moving forward in due order if we next divided up cognitive knowledge.
Certainly.
Pay attention, then, in case we notice some natural split within it.
Tell me what kind you mean.
This kind, we had, I think, an art called calculation.
Yes.
Wholly among the cognitive arts, I'd say.
How could it not be?
Once calculation has grasped the differences among numbers, do we assign it any further task beyond judging what has been grasped?
Of course not.
And likewise, every master builder is not himself a laborer, but a ruler of laborers.
Yes.
Supplying knowledge, that is, not manual work.
Just so.
So he could fairly be said to share in cognitive knowledge.
Certainly.
But it belongs to him, I think, not to be finished and done once he's rendered judgment, the way the calculator was done. Rather, he must go on giving each of the laborers the proper instruction until they've completed what was assigned.
Rightly said.
So all such arts, and every art that goes along with calculation, are cognitive, but these two kinds differ from each other in judging versus commanding.
They appear to.
So if we divided the whole of cognitive knowledge, calling one part the commanding part and the other the judging part, would we say we divided it well?
In my opinion, yes.
And indeed, for people acting jointly on some task, agreement among themselves is a thing to be glad of.
Of course.
So as far as this goes, so long as we ourselves share the same view, we can let everyone else's opinions be, never mind them.
Of course.
Come then, in which of these two arts should we place the kingly art? In the judging one, as if the king were some kind of spectator, or rather should we set him down as belonging to the commanding art, since he is indeed one who rules?
How could it be anything but the latter?
Then we must look again at the commanding art to see whether it too splits somewhere. And it seems to me it does in something like this way. Just as the trade of the retailer is marked off from that of the producer who sells his own goods, so too the kingly class seems to be marked off from the class of heralds.
How so?
Retailers, I take it, take over goods already sold once by others and sell them again a second time.
Quite so.
And in the same way, the tribe of heralds, once given the thoughts of others to carry out, take them over and issue them again, a second time, as commands to others.
Very true.
Well then, shall we lump the kingly art together with the arts of interpreting, of giving the bosun's call, of prophecy, of heralding, and many other arts akin to these, all of which have the giving of commands in common? Or would you rather, since we were making comparisons a moment ago, draw the comparison in name as well, since the class of those who command on their own account happens to be practically nameless, and divide things this way, setting the class of kings within the self-commanding art and leaving all the rest aside, granting to others the task of finding some name for it? For it was for the sake of the ruler that we set out on this inquiry, not for the sake of his opposite.
Certainly.
So then, since this class stands at a reasonable distance from those others, marked off from them by its distinctness, by belonging to itself, isn't it necessary to divide this very thing again if we can still find some cut that yields within it?
Certainly.
And indeed we do seem to have one. Follow along and help me make the cut.
Where?
All those we might think of as ruling by way of giving commands. Won't we find that they command for the sake of bringing something into being?
Of course.
And indeed it isn't at all hard to divide everything that comes into being into two.
How?
Of all such things, some are lifeless and some are living.
Yes.
And it's by these very things that we'll cut the commanding part of cognitive knowledge, if we do want to cut it.
On what basis?
Assigning one part of it to oversee the coming into being of lifeless things, the other to oversee that of living things, and in this way the whole will already have been divided in two.
Entirely so.
Well then, let's set one of these two aside and take up the other, and having taken it up, let's divide the whole of it into two.
Which of the two do you say we should take up?
Surely the one concerned with commanding living creatures. For the kingly kind of knowledge is surely never one that oversees lifeless things, like the master builder's art, but is nobler than that, always exercising its power among living creatures and concerning them.
Rightly said.
And as for the breeding and rearing of living creatures, one might observe that it comes in two forms, the rearing of a single creature and the shared tending of creatures gathered in herds.
Rightly said.
But surely we won't find the statesman to be a rearer of a single creature, like a driver of a single ox or a groom of a single horse. He's more like one who tends a herd of horses or of cattle.
That does appear to be so, now that it's been said.
So shall we call this shared tending of many creatures together, within the rearing of living things, herd rearing, or some sort of communal rearing?
Whichever term happens to suit our discussion.
Well said, Socrates, and if you keep up this habit of not fussing over names, you'll turn out richer in wisdom by the time you're old. But for now, since you tell me to, that's what we must do. Do you see how one might show herd rearing to be twofold, so that what is now sought within a double share will then be sought within a half?
I'll try. It seems to me there's one kind of rearing for human beings, and another again for beasts.
You've divided it with real eagerness and boldness, but let's not fall into the same trap again if we can help it.
What trap?
We shouldn't cut off one small part all by itself against many large parts, nor apart from its proper form. Rather, the part should carry its form along with it. It's finest to separate what we're seeking straight off from everything else, provided the cut is a correct one. The way you, a little while ago, thought you had the right division and rushed the argument forward when you saw it heading toward human beings. But my friend, fine cutting isn't safe. It's safer to go through the middle when we cut, and that way one is more likely to hit upon real forms. This makes all the difference for our inquiries.
What do you mean by that, stranger?
I must try to put it still more plainly, out of goodwill toward your nature, Socrates. It's impossible to make everything fully clear right where we now stand, but I should try to carry the point a little further forward for the sake of clarity.
Then what do you mean? We just did wrongly in our division.
Something like this, as if someone trying to divide the human race in two cut it the way most people here do, setting apart the Greek race as one, separate from all the rest, and then lumping together all the other races, countless, unmixed with one another, and speaking no common tongue, under the single name barbarian, expects that because of this one name it must also be a single race. Or again, as if someone thought he were dividing number into two kinds by cutting off a myriad from the rest of all numbers, setting it apart as one form, and then, giving one name to everything left over on account of that name, claims that this too becomes some other single race, distinct from the first. It would surely be a finer division, and truer to real forms, and more properly a division in two, if one cut number into odd and even, and the human race, in turn, into male and female, and only set apart Lydians or Phrygians or some others against everyone else, whenever one could no longer find a way to divide off both a genuine kind and a genuine part at the same time.
Quite right. But tell me this, stranger, how could one grasp more clearly that a kind and a part are not the same thing, but different?
My excellent friend, that's no small assignment you're setting me, Socrates. We've already wandered further from our main argument than we should have, and now you're asking us to wander even further. So for now, as is only sensible, let's turn back. We can chase that particular trail at our leisure another time. But do be on guard against one thing. Never suppose you've heard a clear, settled account of it from me.
Of what?
That a form and a part are different from each other.
What of it?
Just this, whenever something is a form of a thing, it must also be a part of that thing of which it's called a form, but a part need not be a form. Always take me to be saying that, Socrates, whichever way suits better.
Understood.
Now tell me what comes next.
What?
The point where our wandering off led us here. I think it was mainly this. When asked how herd rearing should be divided, you said, quite eagerly, that there are two kinds of living creature, the human kind, and one other made up of all the rest of the beasts together.
True.
And at the time you struck me as thinking that, by cutting off one part, you'd left the remainder as a single kind, because you had one name to give to all of them, you called them beasts.
That's how it was, yes.
But consider, bravest of men, if somewhere there's some other intelligent creature, the crane, for instance, or something of that sort, it might sort things the same way you did, setting up cranes as one kind, opposed to all other animals, and puffing itself up grandly, while lumping everything else together with humans, and calling it nothing but beasts. So let's try to guard against all mistakes of that kind.
How?
By not dividing the whole class of animals in two, so we're less likely to fall into that trap.
No need to, indeed.
And in fact, that was exactly where we went wrong before.
How so?
The part of the directive kind of knowledge that concerned us was, I take it, some portion of the art of rearing living things, rearing them in herds. Right.
Yes.
Well, even back then, the whole animal kingdom had already been divided into tame and wild. Those with a nature that can be tamed are called domestic, those unwilling to be tamed, wild.
Good.
And the knowledge we're hunting for was, and still is, concerned with tame creatures, and must be sought among herd animals specifically.
Yes.
So let's not divide things the way we did before, looking at everything at once, and rushing to reach statesmanship quickly. That's exactly what got us into trouble just now.
What trouble?
The one the proverb describes. Those who divide carefully, but without haste, get there faster.
And a good thing it did, stranger.
Let's leave that be, then. So, starting over from the beginning, let's try to divide the art of communal rearing. Perhaps the argument itself, once carried through to the point you're so eager for, will show it to you more clearly. Tell me this.
What?
Whether you've often heard about, I know you can't have come across it yourself, the taming of fish in the Nile and in the royal fish ponds. In springs and pools, you may perhaps have noticed it yourself.
Yes, I've actually seen that, and I've heard plenty about the other cases too.
And what about goose rearing and crane rearing? Even if you haven't wandered through the plains of Thessaly, you've certainly heard of it and believe it exists.
Of course.
I asked you all this for one reason. Rearing in herds includes creatures of water and creatures that walk on dry land.
So it does.
Do you agree, then, that we should split the art of communal rearing along this line, assigning each part of it to one of these two, calling one water rearing and the other land rearing?
I agree.
And as for kingship, we won't even need to ask which of the two arts it belongs to. That's obvious to anyone.
Of course.
Everyone would divide the land-rearing branch of herd-rearing further.
How?
By distinguishing winged from earthbound.
Quite right.
Now then, should statesmanship be sought among the earthbound, or don't you think even the least sensible person would assume as much?
I do.
And the art of managing earthbound creatures, like the number we just cut, must be shown split in two.
Clearly.
And indeed, toward the very part our argument has been heading, two roads seem to stretch out before us, one shorter, cutting a small piece against a large one, the other holding more closely to what we said earlier, that we should cut as near the middle as possible, though it's the longer road. We can go whichever way we prefer.
What can't we take both?
Not at the same time, remarkable fellow, but clearly we can take them one after the other.
Then I choose both, one after the other.
Easy enough, since what's left is short. But at the start, or halfway through the journey, that request would have been hard on us. As it stands now, since you prefer it this way, let's take the longer road first. We're still fresh, so we'll manage it more easily. And look at the division.
Go on.
The earthbound tame animals that live in herds are naturally divided in two.
By what?
By this. Some are born hornless, others horn-bearing.
Evidently.
Now divide the art of managing earthbound creatures and assign it, giving an account in words for each part. If you try to name them, the result will be more tangled than it needs to be.
Then how should I put it?
Like this, the science of managing earthbound creatures, once split in two, has one branch set over the horned portion of the herd, the other over the hornless.
Let's leave it stated that way. It's been made clear enough regardless.
And plainly, our king tends some herd that's docked of horns.
How could it be otherwise?
Let's break this herd apart too, then, and try to render him his due.
By all means.
Do you want to divide it by cloven-footed versus what's called single-hoofed, or by cross-breeding versus breeding true to kind? You follow me, surely.
Which?
That horses and donkeys can naturally breed with one another.
Yes.
Whereas the rest of the smooth-coated tame herd doesn't interbreed across kinds.
How could it?
Well then, does the statesman appear to concern himself with a cross-breeding nature, or with one that breeds true?
Clearly the one that doesn't mix.
This too, it seems. We must split in two, as we did before.
Yes, we must.
And indeed, the tame, herding portion of the animal kingdom has now been chopped up entirely, except for two kinds. The dog family isn't worth counting among the herd animals.
No, indeed. But by what do we divide the remaining two?
By the very standard it would be fitting for you and Theaetetus to use in dividing, since you both study geometry.
By what?
By the diagonal, of course, and again by the diagonal of the diagonal.
What do you mean?
The nature our humankind possesses. Isn't it built for locomotion in just the way the diagonal is, whose square is 2 feet?
Exactly so.
And the remaining kind, in turn, has for its power a diagonal relative to our own power, since its nature squares to 2 feet.
How could it be otherwise? And I think I follow pretty well what you mean to show.
Besides this, Socrates, do we notice another thing that's happened in our divisions, the kind of thing that would win a good laugh?
What?
That our humankind has ended up sharing a lot and running the same course as the noblest, and at the same time, laziest of all creatures.
I do notice it, and it's a strange result indeed.
Well, isn't it natural for the slowest to arrive last?
Yes, that much is so.
And don't we realize this too, that the king looks even more ridiculous, running alongside the herd, keeping pace with the man best trained for a life of ease?
Absolutely so.
For now, Socrates, that point made earlier in our inquiry into the sophist becomes clearer still.
What point?
That in this method of reasoning, no more care is given to the dignified than the undignified, nor is the smaller ever slighted in favor of the greater. The method always works out the truest answer purely on its own terms.
So it seems.
Then, so you don't beat me to asking about the shorter road that once led to the definition of the king, let me go there myself first.
Yes, please do.
I say we should have, right at that point, divided the earthbound straightaway into two-footed and four-footed, and then, seeing that the humankind shares its lot only with the winged, cut the two-footed herd again into the featherless and the feathered. Once that was cut, and the art of managing humans thereby made plain, we could bring the statesman and king forward, install him in it like a charioteer, and hand him the reins of the city as his own, since this science belongs to him.
You've paid off the argument handsomely, as if it were a debt, adding the digression as if it were interest and squaring the whole account.
Come then, let's link it all together, going back over the argument for the name of the statesman's art from beginning to end.
Yes, let's.
At the start, we had the directive part of the science of knowing. From this, a portion likened to it was called self-directive. Rearing living things split off as no small part of the self-directive, and rearing in herds was a form of that, and in turn, land-based herd management was a form of herd rearing. From land management, the art of tending the hornless nature was cut off in its turn. And of this, the part is necessarily woven together out of no fewer than three strands, if one wants to gather it under a single name, calling it the art of tending non-interbreeding creatures. What remains from this, the part still left over, applying to the two-footed flock, is human management, and that alone is precisely what we were looking for, called at once kingship and statesmanship.
Exactly so.
But tell me, Socrates, is this really and truly accomplished the way you've just put it?
What do you mean?
That what was proposed has been stated fully and adequately. Or is this exactly where the inquiry falls short, that the argument has been stated after a fashion, but hasn't been worked out completely all the way through?
What do you mean by that?
I'll try to show you, more clearly still, just what I have in mind.
Go on, then.
Now, among the many arts of herding that just appeared, statesmanship was one, and the care of one particular herd.
Yes.
And the argument defined this not as a tender of horses, nor of any other beasts, but as the science of communally rearing humans.
Just so.
Let's look now what sets all herdsmen apart from kings.
What is it?
Whether any of the others, going under the name of some other art, claims and professes to be a fellow rearer of the herd in common with the king.
What do you mean?
Take merchants, farmers, millers, and besides them trainers, and the whole tribe of doctors. You know they'd all fight us tooth and nail if we called the ones who tend to human affairs statesmen, claiming that they themselves look after human nourishment, and not just the nourishment of the common herd, but of the rulers too.
Yes.
Wouldn't they have a point?
Perhaps.
We'll examine that. But here's something we do know. No one will dispute any of this with a cowherd. The herdsman himself is the nurse of his herd, its doctor, its matchmaker, so to speak, and the sole expert in midwifery for the births and labors of his animals. And as far as play and music go, whatever share of that his creatures have by nature, no one is better at soothing and charming them into calm, working the music of his own flock, whether with instruments or with his voice alone. It's the same way with every other kind of herdsman, isn't it?
Exactly right.
Then how can our account of the king look sound and unbroken when we set him up as the sole herdsman and nurse of a human flock, picking him out from 10,000 rival claimants?
It can't.
So weren't we right a little while ago to worry that we might be describing some royal shape without yet having worked out the statesman with real precision? Not until we strip away the crowd pressing in around him, all claiming a share in his pasturing, and separate him from them, showing him alone and clear.
Quite right.
Then that's what we must do, Socrates, if we're not going to disgrace our argument at the very end.
We certainly must not let that happen.
So we need to start again from a different point and travel by another road.
Which road?
One that mixes in a bit of play. We'll need to draw on a large portion of a great myth, and then, as before, keep cutting off part after part until we arrive at the very peak of what we're after. Shouldn't we?
We certainly should.
Then pay close attention to my story, the way children do. After all, you're not so many years past being a child yourself.
Go on, then.
Among the many things told of old and still to be told is the sign that appeared, so they say, in the quarrel between Atreus and Thyestes. You've heard it, and no doubt remember what they say happened then.
You must mean the sign of the golden lamb.
Not at all. I mean the reversal of the sun's rising and setting, and of the other stars too. How the point from which the sun now rises was once the point where it set, and it used to rise from the opposite point, and how the god, bearing witness for Atreus, changed it to its present pattern.
Yes, that story is told too.
And again, we've all heard a great deal about the reign of Cronus.
A very great deal.
And what of the story that people in the earliest times sprang from the earth, rather than being born from one another?
That, too, is one of the old tales.
Well, all of these stem from a single event, along with countless others even more remarkable than these. But because so much time has passed, some of them have died out, while others survive scattered, each told separately from the rest. But no one has told the event that is the cause of all of them, and now it must be told. For once told, it will fit perfectly with our demonstration about the king.
An excellent point, tell it, and leave nothing out.
Listen, then. This whole universe. At times the god himself guides it along its way and helps it turn in its circuit, and at other times he lets it go, whenever its revolutions have completed the measure of time appointed to it, and then it turns back again of its own accord in the opposite direction, being a living creature endowed with intelligence by the one who fitted it together from the beginning. Now this reversal of its motion is built into it of necessity for the following reason.
What reason is that?
To remain always in the same condition and the same state, and to be perpetually the same, belongs only to the most divine things of all. The nature of body does not belong to that order. Now what we have named heaven and cosmos has received many blessed things from the one who begot it, but it has also had a share in body. And for that reason, it is impossible for it to be entirely free of change throughout all time. Still, so far as it is able, it moves as much as possible in the same place with a single motion. Hence it has been allotted the revolving motion, since that involves the least deviation from its own movement. But to turn itself, always by itself, is scarcely possible for anything except the one who leads all moving things. And for that leader to move it now one way, now the contrary way, is not permitted. From all this, then, we must not say that the cosmos turns itself always by itself, nor again that it is turned in its two opposite revolutions entirely by God, nor yet that two gods with opposing intentions turn it in contrary directions. Rather, as was just said, and it's the only option left, at one time it is guided along by another, divine cause, receiving life anew and gaining renewed immortality from the craftsman. And at another time, when it is released, it goes by itself, having been let go at just the right moment so that it travels backward through many tens of thousands of revolutions. Because, being so vast and so perfectly balanced, it moves on the smallest possible pivot.
Well, everything you've described certainly seems to have been said with good reason.
Then, reasoning it out, let's grasp together the event we said was the cause of all those marvels from what has just been said. For here it is.
What is it?
That the motion of the universe is at one time carried in the direction it now revolves, and at another time in the opposite direction.
How so?
We must regard this reversal as the greatest and most complete of all the turnings that occur in the heavens.
So it seems.
Then we should also think that the greatest changes occur at that time for us who dwell within it.
That's likely too.
And don't we know that the nature of living things has a hard time enduring great, many, and manifold changes occurring all at once?
Of course.
So at that time, tremendous destruction of the other living things necessarily occurs, and the human race in particular is reduced to a small remnant. And around these survivors, many other strange and unheard-of things happen, but the greatest is this, which follows directly from the reversal of the whole universe, whenever the turning opposite to the one now established occurs.
What is that?
Whatever age each living creature had reached, this first came to a stop for all of them, and everything mortal ceased advancing toward looking older. Instead, reversing course, it grew younger and more tender again. White hair of the old turned black. The cheeks of the bearded grew smooth again, restoring each man to his bygone prime. The bodies of the young men, growing smooth and smaller day by day and night by night, returned again to the nature of a newborn child, becoming like one in both soul and body. And from that point, withering away entirely, they vanished altogether. As for those who died violently in that time, the corpse underwent these same changes, but rapidly, and was destroyed unseen within a few days.
And what was the birth of living things at that time, stranger? In what way did they beget one another?
Clearly, Socrates, birth from one another did not occur in that order of nature. Rather, the earth-born race, the one said once to have existed, was exactly this. Those who, in that time, turned back again out of the earth. This was remembered by our earliest ancestors, who bordered on the end of the previous revolution and were born at the very start of this one. For they were the ones who became heralds of these accounts to us, accounts that are now wrongly disbelieved by many. For I think we must consider the sequel. It follows from the elders returning to the nature of a child that, in turn, those who had died and lay in the earth should be formed again there and come back to life, following the reversal, as generation itself is cycled back in the opposite direction, and that these, being born from the earth by necessity, according to this account, bear that name and description, all of them, except those whom a god carried off to some other lot.
This certainly follows from what came before, but the life you say belonged to the power of Cronus, did it fall within that earlier turning or within this present one? For as for the change in the stars and the sun, it clearly happens, you say, in both turnings alike.
You followed the argument well. As for what you asked about everything coming to human beings of its own accord, that belongs least of all to the motion now established. It too belonged to the earlier one. For then, first, God himself took charge of the whole revolution, watching over it, and likewise, region by region, all the parts of the cosmos were divided up under the care of gods who ruled them. The animals, too, were divided by kind, and by herd among divine spirits acting as herdsmen, each spirit sufficient in every respect for those under his own charge, so that there was no wildness among them, nor any preying of one on another, nor war, nor strife of any kind whatsoever. There would be countless other things to mention that follow from that kind of ordering. As for what was said about human beings living a life that came of its own accord, It was said for the following reason. A god himself pastured them, taking charge in person, just as now human beings, being another kind of creature more divine than the rest, pasture other lesser kinds. Under his tending, there were no constitutions of states, nor possession of wives and children, for all rose up again out of the earth, with no memory of their former lives. Such institutions were entirely absent, but they had fruit in abundance from trees and much other timber, not raised by cultivation, but produced by the earth of its own accord. Naked and without bedding, they pastured for the most part in the open air, for the seasons were tempered for them so as to cause no distress, and they had soft beds in the abundant grass that sprang up for them from the earth. This, Socrates, is the life you hear of as belonging to the age of Cronus, the life said to belong to the age of Zeus, the present one, you know firsthand, since you are living in it. Could you, and would you, be willing to judge which of the two is the happier?
I could not.
Would you like me to sort it out for you, in a way?
By all means.
Well then, if the nurslings of Cronus, having so much leisure and such power to converse not only with human beings, but with animals as well, used all of this for philosophy, conversing with the animals and with one another, and inquiring of every nature whether any creature, having some power of its own, perceived anything different from the others for the gathering of wisdom. It's easy to judge that the people of that time were immeasurably better off than those of today. But if, stuffed full to bursting with food and drink, they simply told each other, and the animals the sort of tales that are told about them even now, then that too, in my judgment at least, is easy to judge. Still, let's set this aside until some sufficient informant appears to tell us which way the desires of the people of that time ran, regarding knowledge and the use of speech. But we must say why we raised the myth in the first place, so that we can move the argument forward from here. For when the time of all these things was completed, and change had to occur, and indeed the whole earthborn race was already used up, each soul having paid out all its births, as many as had been appointed to it, having fallen as seed into the earth the requisite number of times. Then the pilot of the universe, letting go of the tiller as it were, withdrew to his own place of observation, and fate and innate desire turned the cosmos back again. So all the gods who governed the different regions under the greatest god, once they recognized what was happening, released the parts of the universe from their care. And the universe itself reversed course, colliding start against end, driving itself in the opposite direction, and in shaking itself violently, it brought about yet another destruction of living things of every kind. After that, once enough time had passed, the turmoil and disturbance settled down, the shaking gave way to calm, and the universe fell back into its accustomed orbit, ordering itself, taking charge and control of itself and its own contents, remembering as best it could the teaching of its craftsman and father. At first it carried this out quite precisely, but toward the end more sluggishly. The cause of this was the bodily element in its makeup. The element bred into it from its ancient nature long ago, since it had shared in a great deal of disorder before arriving at the present ordered state. From its composer it has acquired everything beautiful, but from its previous condition it retains and produces in the creatures within it all the harsh and unjust things that occur in the heavens. So long as it raised its creatures together with its helmsman, it produced little that was bad and much that was good. But once separated from him, in the time right after its release it manages everything most beautifully. But as time goes on and forgetfulness grows within it, the ancient condition of disharmony gains the upper hand more and more. And as time draws to its end this disharmony flowers fully, and mixing in only a little good with a great deal of its opposite, the universe comes to the brink of destroying itself and everything within it. That is why, at that point, the god who set it in order, seeing it in distress and caring for it so that it should not be tossed about by confusion, break apart, and sink into the boundless sea of dissimilarity, takes his place again at the helm, turns back what had fallen sick and come apart in its previous cycle under its own power, sets it right, and makes it deathless and ageless. That, then, is the end of the whole account. But for demonstrating what the king is, what has been said already is enough if we take hold of the argument from there. For when the universe turned back onto the path toward the present kind of generation, the aging process stopped again and reversed, and produced results opposite and new compared to what came before. Creatures that had almost vanished from smallness began to grow, while the bodies newly born from the earth, gray-haired at birth, died and returned again to the earth. And everything else changed as well, imitating and following along with what the universe as a whole was undergoing, and in particular, the pattern of conception, birth, and nurture had to follow suit in every creature, out of necessity. For it was no longer possible for a living thing to be formed in the earth through the combined action of others. Rather, just as the universe had been ordered to be in full command of its own course, so in the same way its parts too were now ordered, so far as possible, to grow, beget, and nourish themselves through their own agency, under the same guiding principle. Now we have arrived at the very point toward which the whole account has been driving. As for the other animals, there would be a great deal to say about the various causes behind each one's transformation, but concerning human beings the story is shorter and more to the point. Once deprived of the care of the guardian spirit who had possessed and tended us, and with most of the wild animals, those of savage nature, turning fierce, while we ourselves, weak and unguarded, were being torn apart by them, and still helpless and unskilled in the earliest times, since the food that had once grown of itself had run out, and we did not yet know how to provide for ourselves, having never before been forced by need to do so. For all these reasons we were in dire straits. That is why the gifts from the gods spoken of in the old stories were given to us, along with the instruction and training necessary to use them. Fire from Prometheus, crafts from Hephaestus and his fellow craftswoman, seeds and plants from others still. And everything that has gone into equipping human life has come from these gifts, since, as I just said, the care that came from the gods failed us, and we had to take charge of directing and caring for ourselves, just like the universe as a whole, which we imitate and follow throughout all time, living and growing now in this way, now in that. Let that be the end of the story. We will put it to use in seeing just how far we went wrong in describing the king and statesman in our earlier discussion.
Well then, how great a mistake do you say we made?
In one respect, a smaller one, but in another, a very serious one indeed, and far greater and more extensive than before.
How so?
In this respect, when asked about the king and statesman who belongs to the present cycle and generation, we instead describe the shepherd of the human flock from the opposite cycle, a god rather than a mortal. There we went badly astray. But in showing him as ruler of the whole city, even though we did not specify the manner of his rule, what we said was true, though not complete or clear, so our error there was smaller than the other one.
True.
So it seems we must define the manner of ruling the city precisely, before we can expect the statesman to have been fully described for us.
Well put.
And that is exactly why we brought in the myth, so that it might show, regarding the rearing of a herd, not merely that everyone now disputes this role with the one we are seeking, but so that we might see more clearly that one alone who deserves this title, on the model of shepherds and cowherds, as having charge of the nurture of human beings.
Correct.
But I think, Socrates, that this figure of the divine herdsman is too grand a thing to be called merely a king, while the statesmen who exist here now are much more like their subjects in nature, and share much more nearly in their upbringing and education.
Certainly.
Yet they would have to be sought out no less and no more, whichever nature they happen to have.
Of course.
Let's go back to this point again. We said there was an art of self-directed command over living creatures, exercised not privately but in common, and we called it right then the art of herd-rearing, Do you remember?
Yes.
Well, it was somewhere in this that we went wrong. We never actually captured the statesman or gave him a name. He slipped past us unnoticed under that label.
How?
All the other herdsmen share in the rearing of their particular flocks, but we applied the name to the statesman as though it belonged to him alone, when we ought to have applied some term common to all of them together.
True, if there really is such a common term.
And isn't caring for something common to all of them, regardless of whether we specify feeding or some other particular activity? If we had called it something like herd tending or caretaking or simply oversight, we could have wrapped the statesman together with all the others under it, since that is what the argument called for.
Right, but then how would the next division have gone?
Along the same lines by which we earlier divided herd rearing into land dwelling and winged, mixed breeding and pure breeding, dividing herd tending by these same distinctions, we would have covered both the present kingship and the reign under Cronus alike within our account.
So it appears, but now I'm wondering what would come next.
Clearly, if we had used the term herd tending in this way, no one could ever have objected that there is no such thing as care at all, as was rightly objected before, that there was no art among us worthy of the name, nurture, and that if there were one, it would belong to many others before any king.
Correct.
But no other art would claim to be more entitled, or prior in claim, to care for the entire human community than the art of kingship, exercising rule over all human beings.
You're right.
Now after this, Socrates, do we notice that we made yet another serious error, right at the very conclusion?
What was that?
This, even granting that we had thought through, as clearly as possible, that there is some art of nurturing the two-footed herd, that alone gave us no more right to call it kingship or statesmanship straight away, as though it were already complete.
What then?
First, as I said, we needed to rework the name, directing it more toward care than toward nurture, and then divide this art of care, for it would still admit of divisions that are not small.
Of what sort?
We would have separated, I think, the divine herdsman from the human caretaker.
Correct.
And again, the caretaking assigned to humans would need to be divided in two.
By what?
By force and by consent.
Why so?
Because it was right here that we made our earlier mistake, too naively lumping together king and tyrant, when they and their manner of ruling are utterly unlike one another.
True.
Now, correcting ourselves, as I said, let's divide human caretaking in two, by force and by consent.
Absolutely.
And let's call the caretaking exercised by forced tyranny and the caretaking of willing two-footed creatures exercised with their consent statesmanship, and then declare that the one who possesses this art and this kind of care is truly king and statesman.
And it does seem stranger that our demonstration concerning the statesman would now be complete on this basis.
That would be good for us, Socrates, but it shouldn't seem so to you alone. I need to share that conviction with you. As it stands, in my own judgment, the king still doesn't appear to have taken on his complete shape for us. Rather, like sculptors who sometimes, in their haste at an inopportune moment, pile on more and bigger details than necessary in each part of the work, and so end up slowing themselves down. So too we, wanting to show quickly and impressively the mistake in our earlier account, thought it fitting to construct grand illustrations for the king, took up an amazing mass of myth, and were forced to use more of it than was necessary. That's why we've made our demonstration too long, and haven't brought the myth to a proper conclusion at all. Our discussion is simply like a painted creature that seems to have an adequate outline, but hasn't yet received the vividness that comes from pigments and the blending of colors. Yet for those capable of following it, speech and reasoned account are a better way to display any living thing than painting or any craft using the hands. For everyone else, working with the hands is better.
That's right. But show me where you say our account still hasn't been given adequately.
It's difficult, my friend, to demonstrate anything of importance well without using illustrations. It seems each of us, in a way, knows everything as if in a dream, and then again is utterly ignorant of it all as if wide awake.
What do you mean by that?
I really do seem to have stirred up, rather strangely, just now, our shared condition regarding knowledge.
How so?
My good man, the illustration I used itself now stands in need of an illustration.
Well then, go on, don't hold back on my account.
I must speak, since you're ready to follow along. We know that children, once they've just become familiar with their letters.
What about them?
That they can distinguish each letter well enough within the shortest and easiest syllables, and are able to state the truth about them.
Of course.
And when people are confused about these same letters in other combinations, they again fall into false judgment and false statement about them.
Quite so.
Then isn't this the easiest and finest way to lead people toward the things they don't yet know?
What way?
To bring them back first to the cases where they judged these same letters correctly, and having brought them back, to set that alongside the things not yet known, comparing the two and showing that the same likeness and nature is present in both combinations, until the things truly judged have been set beside all the things not yet known and shown to match them. And once shown in this way, becoming models of this kind, they make it so that every one of the elements in every syllable is called one thing insofar as it differs from the others, and the same thing insofar as it is always consistently itself.
Absolutely.
So we've grasped this well enough. A model comes into being whenever something that is the same, correctly judged in some other, separate case, is brought together with the first case, so that the two together produce a single true judgment.
So it appears.
Then should we be surprised if our soul, having this same natural experience with the elements of all things, sometimes settles into truth about each one in certain combinations, and sometimes again is carried astray about all of them in others, correctly judging some of the combinations in one way or another, but when they're shifted into the long and difficult syllables of actual things, failing to recognize these same elements all over again?
Not surprising at all.
For how, my friend, could someone who starts from a false judgment ever arrive at even a small portion of the truth and gain understanding?
Hardly at all.
So if this is how things naturally work, you and I would do nothing wrong by first attempting to see the nature of a whole pattern in some other small pattern, taken part by part, and then afterward intending to carry that same form, now grown to its greatest size, over from the smaller cases, attempting through this model to recognize by art the proper care of a city, so that we might have waking knowledge instead of a dream.
Quite right.
We must pick up the earlier argument again. Since countless people dispute the kingly class's claim to the care of cities, we said we need to separate out all of them and leave only that one figure, and for this we said we needed some kind of model.
Indeed.
What model, then, having the same character as statesmanship, could someone set out, as small as possible, and thereby adequately discover what we're looking for? Would you like it, Socrates, in Zeus's name, if we have nothing else ready to hand if we choose the art of weaving? And even that, if you agree, not the whole of it. Perhaps the part concerned with woven woolen garments will be enough. For maybe even this portion of it, once chosen, will bear witness to what we want.
Why not?
Then why don't we do with weaving what we did before, dividing part from part each time, and now, going through everything as quickly and briefly as possible, come back around to what's useful right now?
What do you mean?
I'll make the very walkthrough my answer to you.
Well said.
Everything we make or acquire then falls into two kinds, things made for the sake of doing something, and defensive things made so as not to suffer something. And of the defensive things, some are remedies, both divine and human, and others are protections. And of protections, some are weapons for war, others are barriers. And of barriers, some are curtains, others are shelters against storms and heat. And of shelters, some are roofs, others are coverings. And of coverings, some are under coverings, others are wraps. And of wraps, some are cut whole from a single piece, others are composite. And of composite ones, some are pierced and stitched, others bound together without piercing. And of the unpierced ones, some use plant fibers from the ground, others use hair. And of hair coverings, some are glued together with water and earth, others are bound to themselves alone. Now these defenses and coverings made from materials bound to themselves we've named garments. And the art that cares most for garments, just as before we called the art of the city statesmanship, let's now from the thing itself call this garment making. And let's say that weaving, insofar as it concerned the greatest part of garment production, differs from this garment making art in name only, just as before kingship differed from statesmanship only in name.
Quite right.
The next thing to work out is this. Someone might think that calling it garment weaving in this way has been said adequately, without being able to see that it hasn't yet been distinguished from its close collaborators, though it has been separated from many other related arts.
Tell me, related to what?
You haven't followed what's been said, it seems, so we'd better go back and start from the end. If you keep in mind the kinship, you'll see we just now cut off from it the making of bed coverings, separating it by the notions of wrapping around and laying under.
I understand.
And we also removed all the craft that works with flax and hemp and everything else we just called plant fibers. And we separated off felting and the kind of composition that uses piercing and stitching, most of which is shoemaking.
Quite so.
And we removed the care of coverings cut whole from a single piece, leatherworking, and all the arts concerned with roofs, whatever is involved in holding back the elements in building and carpentry as a whole and other arts. And all the arts of barriers that provide protection against theft and violence, involved in the making of lids and the fitting of doors, allotted as parts of the carpenter's craft. And we cut off armor making, being a part of the great and varied power of making defenses. And indeed, we distinguished the whole art of magic concerning remedies right at the start. And we've been left, it seems, with just what we were looking for, the art that works woolen protection against storms, called by the name weaving.
So it seems.
But this hasn't yet been said completely, my boy. For whoever first sets to work on making garments appears to do the opposite of weaving.
How so?
Weaving is, in a way, a kind of interlacing.
Yes.
But the other is a separating of what's compacted and pressed together.
What do you mean?
The work of the carding art. Or shall we dare to call carding weaving and the carder a weaver?
Certainly not.
And again, if someone calls the making of warp and weft weaving, he's using a strange and false name.
Of course.
Well then, should we say that fulling and mending have no share in the care and tending of clothing? Or should we call all these weaving too?
Certainly not.
Yet all of these will dispute with the power of weaving over the tending and production of garments, granting the greatest part to weaving, but also claiming a great deal for themselves.
Quite so.
Besides these, we must also reckon that the arts making the tools by which the works of weaving are accomplished should be considered joint causes of every woven thing.
Quite right.
So will our account of weaving, of the part we chose, be adequately defined if we set it down as the finest and greatest of all the arts of caring for woolen clothing? Or would we be saying something true but not yet clear or complete until we've stripped away all these other arts from it as well?
Right.
Then shouldn't we do next what we're describing, so our account proceeds in order?
Of course.
First, then, let's observe that there are two arts involved in everything that's done.
Which two?
One that is a joint cause of coming into being, and one that is the cause itself.
How do you mean?
Whatever arts don't produce the thing itself, but supply tools to the arts that do, tools without which the task assigned to each art could never be carried out, these are joint causes. But the arts that produce the thing itself are the causes.
That makes sense anyway.
After this, then, shall we call all the arts concerned with spindles, shuttles, and whatever other tools share in the production of clothing, joint causes, and the arts that actually tend and produce the clothing itself, causes.
Quite right.
Of the causes, then, washing and mending, and all the care given to these matters. Since there's a great deal of grooming involved, it's reasonable to gather up that whole portion under one name and call it the art of fulling.
Well put.
And carding and spinning, and all the parts concerned with the actual making of the clothing we're talking about, are one single art among all those commonly named, wool working.
Of course.
Now wool working has two divisions, and each of these two is at the same time a part of two other arts.
How so?
Carding and half of shuttle work, and everything that separates things joined together, all of this, taken as one, belongs to wool working, and there are two great arts running through everything, the art of combining and the art of separating.
Yes.
To separating, then, belong carding and everything just mentioned. For the separating done among wool and warp threads, done one way with the shuttle, another way by hand, has received all the names just given.
Quite so.
Now let's again take up the part that is at once a part of combining and of wool working. And let's set aside everything there that belonged to separating, dividing wool working in two, into the separating part and the combining part.
Let it be divided.
Now you must divide again, Socrates, the combining part that is also a part of wool working, if we're going to adequately grasp the weaving we set out to define.
We must indeed.
We must indeed. So let's say that one part of it is twisting, the other interlacing.
Do I follow, then? You seem to me to mean by twisting the working of the warp thread.
Not only that, but of the weft as well. Or shall we find some way its production happens without twisting?
Certainly not.
Then define each of these two as well. The distinction may prove timely for you.
How so?
Like this, of the works of carding, we call the part that has been drawn out lengthwise and given width a sliver, don't we?
Yes.
And of this, the part twisted by the spindle and made into a solid thread, call this thread the warp, and call the art that straightens it out the art of warp spinning.
Right.
Now, as for whatever fibers take on a loose twist, and by the interweaving of the warp acquire just the right softness relative to the pull of carding. Let's call the spun result of this the weft, and the craft assigned to work it the weft spinning art.
Quite right.
And indeed the part of weaving we originally set out to find should now be clear to everyone. For when the combining branch of wool working produces, by the straight interlacing of weft and warp, a woven fabric, we call the whole woven result a woolen garment, and the craft responsible for it we call weaving.
Quite right.
Well then, why on earth didn't we simply answer straight away that weaving is the interlacing of weft and warp, instead of going round and round, making countless distinctions for nothing?
For my part, stranger, none of what was said struck me as pointless.
And no wonder, though it might well strike you that way before long, my good man. Against that kind of complaint, should it come over you again later, and it very well might hear an argument that applies to all cases of this sort.
Just tell me.
First, then, let's look at excess and deficiency across the board, so that we can properly praise or blame, according to reason, whatever is said at greater length than it should be on any given occasion, and the opposite in discussions of this kind.